Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed into law the nation's first over-the-counter access to HIV prevention drugs. Dr. Carlos Malvestuto is an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Ohio State Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
How significant is it to get these kinds of drugs over the counter? It's not like you can buy them off the shelf, but it is over the counter. Is it significant?
Yes, I think it can make a big difference. What we know about this medication for pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP is that it's very effective and it's also very safe. It's been approved in the U.S. since 2012. So there's a lot of experience with it, and it's a medication that we've used very well and very effectively. So if taken correctly, it can protect people from acquiring HIV even when they're exposed, and the protection rates are, over 95%. One problem that we've had in general is that we know that there's a certain number of people who are at risk of acquiring HIV, but the proportion of those people who have actually been offered PrEP and who have taken PrEP is relatively low. There's an estimate that probably in the U.S. About a million people, are candidates, and that's probably a conservative estimate, to go on PrEP. But yet only about 20%, have ever started PrEP. So by providing it more easily and increasing access in new ways, then we hope to increase that number. And by doing that, then we are likely to prevent new cases of HIV, and actually that would lead to a significant decrease in the number of new cases.
The California law also permits pharmacists to dispense post-exposure drugs. How do those work?
Sure. So what the post-exposure prophylaxis is actually a combination of medication, a cocktail of drugs that are given. These are also very safe. But the important point is that when somebody may have been exposed to HIV, this needs to be started within 72 hours of exposure. It does not work if it's started later than that. There are cases when, somebody may realize, I could have been exposed. What do I do? And, they may go to the emergency department, but they may not really know, what to do at that point. And time is of the essence. So by making it available through a local pharmacy and being able to go there without a prescription to actually start it within that 72-hour period, then that can prevent a new infection of HIV. So I think that's an essential point. It's very important. This is analogous to Plan B for birth control becoming available without a prescription. And it's the same idea that if taken within that short period of time, then it can actually prevent, in this case, a new HIV infection.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Carlos Malvestuto. He's an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed into law the nation's first over-the-counter access to HIV prevention drugs, both a drug that is a post-exposure drug, as the doctor mentioned, within 72 hours after contact, and pre-exposure drugs that can significantly reduce the risk of contracting the disease. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Has cost of the drugs been an issue, Dr. Malvestuto?
So that is a concern that is always raised, but the truth is that there are so insurance covers it, Medicaid covers it, but we know that many of particularly young people out there who may be at risk, may lack insurance or may not have enrolled in a program. So, for example, in Ohio, we have there are funds that allow us to provide medication to people without insurance. The manufacturer actually has a patient assistance program that will cover medication for those who are otherwise uninsured as well. So there are different. That has never been an issue for us in being able to prescribe the medication. So the cost is not to the patient. It should not really be a barrier. But it is there is a perception that you know that this is a something that would prevent them from actually being able to access the medication. Now, in fact, Columbus Public Health at their sexual health clinic, they have staff that will actually help people who are interested in going on PrEP to not only be linked to a clinic that will prescribe the medication, but also will set them up so that they have the appropriate coverage for the medication.
USA Today reporter Sam Metz has been covering the issue in California. He joins us now. Welcome, Sam Metz.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sam, was there much opposition to this bill in California?
So, at the end, most of the opposition agreed to remove their opposition to the bill. But throughout the process, there were doctors groups and Kaiser who opposed the bill. The California Medical Association, which is a doctor's lobby, opposed mm-hmm. the bill.
Why?
Well, I think whenever there's a power struggle between pharmacists, nurses, and doctors, in California state government at least, you do get doctors, physicians groups, or kind of other medical professional groups coming out on either side of the bill. And I think they had legitimate concerns about safety, and they just, you know, they feel like they have the expertise to prescribe these medications, and they worry about having some of their power removed.
And what do you say to that, Dr. Malvestuto?
Yeah, I think that the concerns initially by the California Medical Association were legitimate. So this is, medication that is very safe. However, there are certain contraindications, and also it's important for a person who goes on PrEP to have follow-up with a medical provider, because we do have to verify that, for example, that they're not already infected with HIV at the time that they start the medication, or that they acquire it while they're on it, because if they continue on the PrEP drug with active infection, then what will happen is that the virus will become resistant to the components of the medication. And in fact, it will make their treatment of HIV more difficult later on. So medical follow-up is important. However, I absolutely agree with the idea of providing access, starting people on it. So I think the compromise was actually that patients could get up to 60 days of medication, but would then follow up with a medical provider. And I think that's a reasonable compromise.
Sam Metz, how does the law work, and how is it going to work in California? What's going to be the procedure?
So, yeah, you can get a one-time prescription for PrEP or PEP at a pharmacy, and then you go to the doctor and follow up for your next prescription, which was the compromise to ensure that people are tested and that we're not developing drug resistance. So that mm-hmm. was the compromise.
Is there records
like the
kept?
Doctor,
yeah.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I think like the doctor said, there are misperceptions over cost of PrEP. Mm-hmm. And they've had, like, research has shown that people have had some trouble convincing people to get on this drug. So I think the hope of the lawmakers and activists behind this bill is that doing it this way will get more people on the drug and more people into seeing doctors in the long run.
And Dr. Malvestuto, the significance of it being California. California leads the way on a lot of things. And it's what direction California takes, often so goes the nation. Is that your hope?
Yes, that's very much our hope. And, again, we've when we look at the PrEP experience from particularly in different cities, we see that it has been tremendously effective. One need only look at the experience in San Francisco, where PrEP was made widely available. So there was a campaign where they worked on all aspects of prevention and treatment of HIV, so making sure that people had access to testing, and that if they tested positive for HIV, they would be linked to care rapidly, as well as, if they for those who tested negative and were at high risk, they would be started on PrEP. And the number of new HIV cases decreased from about 520 in 2008 to only 197 in 2018. So there has been a steady decrease in new cases of HIV. And, New York has had a similar experience. Washington, D.C. has had a similar experience. And in countries where it has been adopted widely, we see a similar thing as in Australia. So we know that this works very well. So whatever we can do to increase access to the people who need it, who are at highest risk, and also making sure that, those who have access are really the ones who are, disproportionately affected, and that may not be have, a regular medical provider, that may be outside of, healthcare coverage. Those are the particular patients that we really need to, make this available to.
The CDC reports that the number of sexually transmitted diseases, disease cases, increased to a record high last year. For starters, Dr. Malvestuto, is that the case with HIV as well? I mean, I know it's a sexually transmitted disease, but did it increase the way others did?
So HIV hasn't, the number of cases of, so the annual incidence of HIV cases has not increased. But what's concerning is that in the U.S. overall, the number of new cases has stagnated in that we have not seen, after several years of seeing a steady decrease, we've remained at around 38,000 to 40,000 new cases every year. Which indicates that there's still a lot of work to do to be able to bring that number down even more. And since we know that we have the tools to be able to do that, we should be doing better for a number of reasons. We know that even without a cure, we actually have the tools to end the HIV epidemic. So by providing improving prevention through pre-exposure prophylaxis, but also we know that if for people who have HIV, who are living with HIV, if they go on treatment and they maintain viral suppression, they cannot transmit the virus. So actually providing treatment is a form of prevention as well. So if we're able to do all those pieces, then we should be able to bring down the number of new cases more rapidly. So that is the concern with that. Now, when it comes to the new STD, the peaks that we've seen and the record number of new STDs, particularly chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, there are several reasons for this. On the one hand, we know that people have easier access to testing, which is actually a good thing because it means that they can be tested and they can then be treated. But we also know that, there has been a decrease in the use of condoms, particularly among young people. And in several STD clinics around the country, there there have been funding cuts as well. So it is a mix of different reasons why this is happening, but it does also tell us that we need to be doing a better job of diagnosing people with STDs and being able to offer them treatment much more easily.
And Sam Nutz, I'm curious: is there a public information piece to this legislation, or a public education piece?
There isn't with this legislation, but I think the hope is that getting people into physicians and overcoming some of the roadblocks that stop people from getting on PrEP or PEP will lead to further education.
Sam Metz, reporter for the Palm Springs Desert Sun and USA Today. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Dr. Carlos Malvestuto, Assistant Professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And we have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The dental industry is using more technological advancements to treat patients, including digital scanners and 3D printers to offer same-day crown replacements. Dr. Matthew Messina is a dentist and editor of Ohio Dental Association's publications. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
Journalist and author Janet Morrissey recently wrote about the new advancements in dental care for the New York Times. We'll post a link to her article on WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, Janet Morrissey.
Nice to be here.
You wrote about new tech and dental care. You called the dental industry a sector undergoing a technological metamorphosis. That's a mouthful, and it's a big claim. I mean, how significant of a change are we talking?
The advances really are game-changing. I mean, they are using, as you mentioned earlier, digital scanners, artificial intelligence, augmented reality, and other technologies that the medical field has been using for years to make all kinds of revolutionary advances there. But in the dental industry, we had not seen those technologies being used, and now they are, and it's making it easier, faster, in some cases less painful to fix broken or crooked teeth. So it really is a game-changing time.
Dr. Messina, what do you make of the lag between the larger medical profession and the dental profession?
Well, I think one of the best parts to think about this is it's a wonderful time to be a dental patient. Really, with all the advances, there's almost nothing that we can't fix these days and get people back together and looking like themselves and feeling like themselves. But the nature of dentistry, you know, what's required of quality dentistry doesn't change. We evolve with the technology and the new science as it comes to pass. We look at the evolving evidence. You know, we're teaching evidence-based dentistry to the students so that they could adapt in the future to whatever changes come our way. The challenge with dentistry as opposed to medicine is the majority of dental practices are small businesses, and adding technology into an office like that, as the head of a practice, I tell my patients all the time, I'm the steward of their money, and so I want to make sure that we invest that wisely, because we're trying to balance the fact of providing the absolute best dental care possible, while at the same time keeping the cost, affordable for people.
You know, Janet Morrissey, you start out your article with the story of Teresa Gucciardo Perry, who had a cracked crown. She's been through 18 root canal procedures, which made my head hurt just reading that. She's had 5 implants with crowns on all but her front teeth. Compare and contrast what she used to go through with what these new advancements have brought her.
Well, what she used to hate the most was the procedure where they take the molds, where they have to put these large trays filled with this putty-like substance into your mouth, and you sit there, and they do the X-rays and so forth. And it used to make her gag. She hated it. And then after that procedure was over, often the implants or the crowns, whichever she was getting, didn't fit, and she'd have to go through the whole process all over again. Well, now you have digital scanners where you just put a wand in the person's mouth. You move the wand around, it takes 3D images of the teeth and the bite and everything, and it's sent electronically, you know, instantaneously to either a lab or to your computer if you have a 3D printer in your office.
Uh-huh.
And it makes it more accurate, it's faster, it's easier. This is one of the reasons some people can get same-day implants even, and crowns.
This sounds like a big deal, Dr. Messina, is it?
The 3D scanners, and that offers an opportunity, certainly from a patient's perspective, it is easier. Nobody loves impressions. The end result is that we can get wonderful dentistry either way, and it's about trying to find a way that works the best for your office and your patients. The scanners have really advanced in technology these days, and we're going to continue to see growth in that sector as far as dental offices, yeah.
Now, the putty never really bothered me. is it a lot less? I mean, are we talking a lot more expense for people? A lot more people don't have dental insurance than medical insurance.
Well, when you're running a small business, any investment that you make in technology or anything else in the office, whether it's people or technology, that adds to the bottom line and the cost of care. So what you have to balance is adding the technology increasing our ability to do quality dentistry and saving in other ways that we're producing a better end result.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the cost of that investment in technology is borne by the practice. It's a cost of doing business. And so that, you know, being a business, that shows in the cost of care.
Janet Morrissey, what are some other innovations that have stood out to you?
Well, there's other systems as well, like the CAD-CAM system, which allows, that's where the dentist can make same-day crowns, veneers, bridges right in the office on the same day. It captures the image virtually, designs the crown virtually, and then sends the design to either a milling machine or a 3D printer if they have it in that office. So what could take normally several visits over the course of a couple of weeks suddenly takes only 2.5 hours in a dentist's office. There's also a cone beam technology, which changes the way implants are done. It captures 3D X-ray images through this machine that rotates around the patient's head, and it allows a surgeon to create these surgical guides that they print out, and then they use during the surgery so that they know exactly where the dental implants go, and it makes it easier, faster, and more accurate. But I think the biggest advances of all have been in orthodontics.
Hmm.
I mean, we have digital smile technology, which uses scanners and augmented reality and 3D printing and so forth to show patients how they'll look with those new crowns or with those straightened teeth even before the procedure is done. They can see it virtually on a computer, or a dentist can even use a 3D printer to create a model that's placed on the patient's mouth, kind of like those old Hollywood teeth that you'd see.
Yeah.
So you'd get an idea ahead of time what you'll look like. And so those are interesting. And then, of course, there's on the orthodontic side, there's 3D printed clear aligners, you know, made by companies like Invisalign and ClearCorrect,
mm-hmm.
and so forth, and where basically they use 3D printers to print out these aligners, you know, each month, and you change them and you don't have to go into the dentist. But I think one of the biggest and most recent advances is this company called Mechanodontics. It's a startup, and they invented this product called Breas. And this is a technology that can straighten teeth without the use of braces or aligners. Instead, they put these tiny springs on brackets behind the teeth. And the springs, the shape and the angle of the springs provide the force that moves the teeth. And once they're installed, you don't have to have any weekly or monthly adjustments until the treatment's finished. And the treatment is half the time it takes for regular braces. So that one is a really a groundbreaking one.
Dr. Messina, I also read about digital tools that detect oral cancer. I know the dentist always checks out my mouth. What do these digital tools do?
Well, I think that, in answering to Janet's statement there too, what's really great about dentistry these days is we're getting more and more tools in our toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's fabulous for patient care is that, companies are investing from a research and development standpoint into looking at new technologies and different ways of doing things. And then we as a profession have to look at the research and look at the studies. And from an evidence standpoint, you know, when the evidence supports a change in technology or process, then we move with that and adapt to the new technologies. And that's part of, you know, the profession's always evolved. I've been practicing for 32 years now, and when I consider the changes in dentistry from when I graduated from Ohio State in 1987 to now, it's mind-boggling to see the growth of technology and different things we can do, which is fabulous that I have so many more options to offer to patients and different, you know, things to pull out of my bag of tools here to help them. The process with oral cancer screening, visual exam and using radiographs or x-rays of the teeth and the jaws continue to be the gold standard of things. But if we can use technology to augment our eyes or use artificial intelligence to augment our eyes and ability to read things,
mm-hmm.
you know, if as that proves to be beneficial, we're certainly going to move in that direction. Absolutely.
How does that work? I mean, you're putting something in someone's mouth and it's detecting things that your eye can't?
There are some different ways of doing that. We're also seeing, within the aspects of radiology, both on the medical side and the dental side, artificial intelligence algorithms review the images for patterns and identify those and offer contrast to make it easier to see.
Also, lasers that eliminate the need for an anesthetic. How big of a deal is that? Because anesthesia is been a big deal in dentistry forever.
Well, that's the one part that that nobody loves, but we have learned the ability to provide anesthesia for patients to get them thoroughly numb and do that comfortably. So
mm-hmm.
we've cleared that hurdle. But everybody's always looking for a different way to clean out the decay in the teeth. And we've got everything from whether it's lasers, vaporizing the decay, to there's other advances in non-mechanical techniques. A potential future paradigm shift in dentistry is a product called silver diamine fluoride that stops or arrests the growth of decay without drilling in the teeth, and that's going to revolutionize both the pediatric side and the geriatric side of dentistry when we combine that with some other different materials that we can use to fill teeth. It really is opening new frontiers to do more dentistry without the need of drilling on the teeth.
And Janet Morrissey, what's a smart toothbrush?
Well, that's where they use 3D motion sensors and artificial intelligence to track the time, the duration, the frequency, and the location of your brush as you're brushing. And it alerts the person to areas that they've missed through an app on your phone. The founder who came up with this idea, he was from a company called, he made this company, Colibri. His name was Thomas Durval. And he came up with the idea when he was trying to find ways to get his daughter to brush her teeth. She just hated brushing her teeth, but she loved playing with his iPhone. So he decided he'd add mobile phones, or mobile games rather, to the app, where they give virtual rewards when the person brushes all of the quadrants correctly. So it's quite interesting. Looking ahead in the future, they think that a lot of people will be using phone apps to track their oral health, sort of similar to the way Apple Watches track fitness right now. When I spoke to Dr. Gallucci at the Harvard School of Dental Medicine, he said he sees people hooking up these intraoral devices like a wand that it would be attached to their phone. They'd scan their teeth for plaque buildup, cavities, and even cancer. And then the data would be collected and sent to the dentist to see if a visit's necessary. That's where he thinks the future is.
Wow. What do you think about that, Dr. Messina?
Well, you know, it's always kind of interesting to think about your phone ratting you out. You come into the dentist office and we say, well, have you been flossing and have you been brushing? Oh, yes, three times a day and twice on Sundays. All right, hand over your phone, and you know, the phone will tell the tale. So we'll all have a good laugh about that. But this is, you know, the way our phones are interacting with our lives from a health standpoint. But you know, anything. I'm in favor of anything that improves the success of people taking care of their teeth. And if using an app on your phone helps you to brush better and more thoroughly, or your kids, I'm all for that, because we know how important oral health is as far as overall body health. And so, we're all in favor of moving that in the right direction for patients.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about the insurance implications. Janet Morrissey, did you look into that? If it's one thing to have your phone rat you out, it's another thing to have it rat you out to your insurance provider, who says, dude, if you don't clean your teeth better, we're not going to pay for your dentist.
That's an interesting dilemma. I had not thought of that, but that's true.
I'm always thinking about the money
part. No, it is. It's a very interesting dilemma.
Dr. Messina, you know, I wanted to ask you while I have you on, just
sure.
our overall approach to dentistry and how we separate it from our health care. So there's dental care and then there's health care. And I know people who have gotten septic shock from teeth ailments. It's a big problem in a lot of medical clinics. They often have dentists there because people are sick from from oral health or from oral illness.
And you're right in one of my favorite topics. The mouth is connected to the rest of the body.
Yeah.
And so bacteria present in the mouth do have direct access into the rest of the body. And one of the things that we talk about emerging research, looking at periodontal disease, gum disease, bacteria in the mouth causes an inflammatory reaction on the part of the body. That inflammation has direct connections to cardiovascular disease, control of diabetes, even Alzheimer's disease is an area of emerging research. So just about any aspect of overall body health shows itself in the mouth, and then the mouth interacts with the body. So if we can improve somebody's oral health, which actually is an easy step for people to take, then we can affect their full body health and their long-term life expectancy in response to other systemic disease. So this is something that's vitally important going forward, is to talk to, we talk to patients all the time about how the health in their mouth affects their whole body.
Well, Dr. Matthew Messina, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here.
Dr. Matthew Messina, he is a Central Ohio dentist, and he's editor of the Ohio Dental Association, for the Ohio Dental Association. Also, Janet Morrissey, thanks for your time today as well. I appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Janet Morrissey wrote an article for the New York Times about new technology in the dentistry field. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. We'll be right back with more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 3 out of 4 Americans older than 60, and that amounts to about 48 million Americans, have some kind of hearing loss. But just a fraction, just about 14% of them, use technology to improve their hearing. Hearing aids can do more than ever. That's the irony. Nicholas Reed is an assistant professor of audiology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is that 3 out of 4 Americans older than 60 statistic having some kind of hearing loss, is that new? Is it are we have worse hearing? Are we losing our hearing more?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily new. I think the bigger deal is that no one had really sat down to calculate out those statistics before. You know, we've made massive strides, actually, in some of the noise exposure for, you know, in OSHA, in the workplace, so we can assume that adults aren't being exposed to that same degree of potentially dangerous noise in the workplace. However, you know, on the flip side, there is this whole issue of iPads and iPods and mm-hmm. other MP3 devices, and perhaps teenagers are listening at too loud of levels, and adults, and perhaps that may be contributing to something. But I personally believe the trade-off is probably null, and it's the same amount of hearing loss we've always kind of seen, the same incidence. The bigger picture here, though, is that the United States is aging at such a rapid pace, and this demographic of our population is increasing so rapidly that if we continue on this pace, actually, it's not that more people are developing hearing loss. It's just that more people are in the age bracket that have hearing loss. Some projections from our lab actually show that by 2060, that number is going to almost double to 76 million adults in the United States having hearing loss.
Is environment the only cause of hearing loss, or is sometimes it just genetic? My mom started losing her hearing when she was 50, and she never listened to anything louder than a symphony.
Yeah, so we know that noise is a risk factor for hearing loss, but the truth is, we don't understand hearing loss really, really well. When we look at large epidemiologic data sets, we see the largest risk factors for hearing loss are actually age, race, and sex or gender. You know, men are more likely to have hearing loss than women. There's actually a relationship between hearing and melanin such that Black Americans are less likely to have hearing loss than white Americans. There's a protective factor of melanin. And then age is the largest driver of hearing loss. But when I say these things and I'm telling you these demographic risk factors, mm-hmm. it really means that in general, we don't know. There is a genetic component here, and we don't know the exact ins and outs of this. You know, there's research that also shows cardiovascular complications like diabetes and hypertension are risk factors for hearing loss, but how much they contribute to hearing loss is sort of still up for debate.
Is part of the problem that, as far as why don't we know more? I mean, there must be research going on all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, our center here at Johns Hopkins, I work at the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health. We are the only center in the world at a school of public health focused on age-related hearing loss. And perhaps the problem is, as you said, it doesn't get a lot of attention. You know, hearing loss has traditionally always been this sort of benign aspect of aging, right? You know, when we thought about it from a public health side and a clinical side, we were like, well, you know, everyone your age has hearing loss, and you know, you can do something about it if you'd like. But recent epidemiologic research, a lot of it out of our lab here, shows that hearing loss is actually related to many significant healthy aging factors. It's associated with dementia, cognitive decline, falls, health resource utilization, and these are the things that matter as we age. And as I noted, as we're this society rapidly aging, we really, I think, are starting to focus on hearing loss as a healthy aging factor, and it's really why you're seeing all this sort of sudden attention in the past 5 years.
Why have hearing aids been so expensive?
Yeah, that's a great question. Hearing aids as an area of healthcare are something that, you know, it's interesting. It's born out of, you know, the whole audiometry field is born out of World War II. All these veterans coming back with hearing loss from massive noise exposure.
Yeah.
People are living longer. Hearing aids, you know, they start coming online in the 50s and 60s, but they're these large, bulky items. And it wasn't until really the past 20 years where you see this sort of modern hearing aid that is small and indiscreet and can do a lot and actually can digitally transform sound. But to make those advances, it costs a lot of money for those companies on research and development. I think now that a lot of the research has been done, there's some companies out there making pretty good products that, you know, they can leverage economies of scale and make something pretty strong that's comparable for a much less expensive price. The whole design of the hearing loss delivery models in the U.S. is sort of this low volume, high cost instead of high volume, low cost, just by nature of right now under current legislation, to purchase a hearing aid, you have to go through a licensed individual. So there's sort of some layers here. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That comes out of the need where, you know, I told you earlier hearing aids were big, they were bulky, they were kind of difficult to manage.
Mm-hmm.
You needed a professional. So that legislation where you had a licensed individual sell the hearing aid made a lot of sense in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s up until recently. Now we have smartphones, digital connections. We can sort of program the hearing aids ourselves. And there's a lot more sort of flexibility, I think, and it maybe makes sense to start to decouple the hearing aid device from the services of the professional.
Elizabeth Warren, candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, sponsored legislation that's called the Over-the-Counter Hearing Aid Act of 2017. President Trump has signed it into law. What does this mean to people out there?
Yeah, so that act, which was part of the FDA Reauthorization Act, it was a rider on that. It was bipartisan, supported, and what it really means is that by the year 2020, August 2020, the Food and Drug Administration has until that time to build the regulatory framework for over-the-counter hearing aids, meaning hearing aids that can be purchased by an individual without the need for going through that licensed individual. And there's a small stipulation here that these devices have to be customizable, or they can be manipulated by the individual, right? So they can't be sort of locked devices that require going back to the an audiologist or a hearing aid dispenser just mm-hmm. to fit. Now, I think the key here is, though, that these devices are really for mild to moderate hearing loss, which that makes up the vast majority of hearing loss. Individuals with severe and profound hearing loss will still actually be under the same regulatory framework that already existed. The vast majority of hearing aids currently purchased in the country, the highest percent are really under that severe and profound group. They're much more likely to own hearing aids than those with mild and moderate loss. So what it does essentially is sort of what I was talking about. The bill sort of decouples for mild and moderate hearing loss the device versus the services. And it doesn't mean that an individual couldn't go get the services. It just means that they could buy the device in Walmart and then take it to an audiologist themselves when they need help mm-hmm. and when they need those services. Some of us on the public health side really view this bill as a big win because it increases access and affordability. We see companies, you've already seen Bose, actually, with an FDA-approved hearing aid. They've gone through the process, and you are likely to see other major consumer brands get in, kind of increasing competition, which is going to increase sort of rapid technology advances for the public. But you also see in this framework, you know, by having increased access, people may be more likely to buy hearing aids earlier when they first notice a problem. Right now, one of the issues when people try to adopt hearing aids, it's such a slow, insidious, chronic condition, right? Mm. We don't notice hearing loss until it's pretty well advanced, and we tend not to do anything until it's pretty well advanced. And that actually contributes to many people failing to adjust to hearing aids. By having an option out there for the public at an earlier time point, I actually think we're going to see more people adopting hearing aids early on when it can make a difference in their lives, and then eventually maybe transitioning as their hearing loss degrades over time. You know, unfortunately, most people's hearing loss only gets worse over time. It's slow, it's insidious, but they're going to be able to really adjust to their hearing aids and sort of maximize their benefit over the course of their lifetime as an older adult in the United States.
What's happening inside the ear when your hearing degrades? What's going on in there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So essentially, you know, what you hear people talk about all the time are, you know, the hairs in my ear, right, are dying. And so the ear is a complicated organ, really. And so, you know, you have your ear that you see, sound comes in, it moves your eardrum, and then it moves these three small bones. And then it gets to what we call the cochlea. And in the cochlea is where we actually sort of encode the sound. And we say we have hairs in the ear because we have these cilia, these cells with cilia that kind of look like, you know, little cartoon characters with three hairs kind of sticking out maybe. And those cells are actually, you know, essentially dying to some degree, and then they're not able to encode sound anymore. So we have sort of an erosion, loss of the hair cells, as we call them. And again, you know, like we talked about in the beginning of this, we don't fully understand exactly why these cells experience cellular death.
And they don't grow back, I guess.
They do not grow back. There is, you know, there was recent news. There's actually a phase two clinical trial going on right now from a group in Boston that is maybe a promising pharmacologic intervention for restoring hearing, but we're still a ways off of that. So right now there is currently no way to grow back the cellular area of the ear.
And what do hearing aids do?
So hearing aids essentially are taking sound in and, you know, at a very simple level, they're taking sound in and they're making it louder, but it's much more complicated than that. All of our hearing loss is very different, right? You know, many people think of hearing loss from this concept of a volume issue, but hearing loss is a clarity issue. What's really going on is you're missing various frequency ranges of sound. So perhaps if you think about for speech, you know, you can hear vowels just fine. They're very low frequency. They are sort of high energy. But soft consonants like the F sound or the S sound, uh-huh, they become sort of unclear. So what hearing aids do is they only apply the amplification in the specific area where you need it. So it's very customized for your own hearing loss. Not everybody has the exact same configuration. And at the same time, hearing aids are actually sort of compressing sound, because if you can imagine, if you have a lot of hearing loss, and you make things louder, you know, your experience of what's loud didn't change, right? An airplane is still loud for someone with hearing loss. It's the threshold floor that changed. So we need to sort of adjust the ratio of sound for people just to make life a little bit more pleasing. This was why, you know, a long time ago when all we could do was make things louder across the board, people uh-huh complained all the time hearing aids were too loud.
Is there any evidence that actually made the hearing worse? Because I'm constantly turning down the dial on my headphones when I'm on the air, when I'm recording anything. I'm afraid of losing my hearing because of my experience with my mom. Is there any evidence that by using hearing aids, it degrades your ears or the cilia faster?
No, I don't think so. I've never seen evidence of that, not with modern hearing aids. Perhaps you could have made that case with the older hearing aids that just made everything, you know, astronomically louder. But now we have a lot of actually, you know, almost like fail-safe switches in the hearing aids that if they got a sound too loud, they actually don't amplify it, and they actually act as sort of a plug in your ear because there's something already in there, perhaps almost being protective. So there's a lot of thought given to that, but I don't know of any evidence that shows that wearing hearing aids will actually make things worse over time.
And what is the condition when you're in a room of crowded people that affects your ability to hear? Why is that?
Yeah, so, you know, our brains, you know, this is true for everybody. Our brains have to deal with all these competing signals, and it's very, very difficult to pull out what's a signal you want to hear when there's background noise, especially at the same level or even louder than that signal. And you can imagine when you have hearing loss, even mild hearing loss, that becomes a very, very arduous task for your brain to say, you know, that's the voice I want to hear, even though there are 200 other voices in here or loud voices. And it becomes difficult. Some people call this, you know, the cocktail effect, cocktail room effect, things like that. But essentially, speech and noise is something very difficult for our brains to deal with regardless. And hearing loss makes it a lot more difficult. There's a lot of assistive devices for hearing aids to try to maximize the signal-to-noise ratio to overcome this.
Nicholas Reed, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicholas Reed is an assistant professor of audiology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.